Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
So, very rustic and not technical, but it worked.
Whatever works.
Yep.
I mean, you're here.
Yep.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about the Iditarod, where we are all about rustic and not being too technical. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. That was Iditarod rookie musher Allison Lifka you just heard from. Before we fix up our sleds and get out on the trail, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Well, it's the weekend. We told you Friday about Nicholas Petit, the Girdwood musher, being the first to reach the Yukon River, winning that five-course meal. And right now, it's Saturday. We've seen some leapfrogging at the front of the pack. As I'm recording this, Bethel's Pete Kaiser has been in the lead for a bit. Petit's team right behind him, heading up the Yukon River out of Eagle Island. Jesse Royer and Yor Olsom, the defending champ, not far behind. We're going to hear more from Olsom here in a minute about how he is carrying the ashes of a friend of his and a former Iditarod musher, Rudy Demoski, out on the trail. That's coming up. Olsom was the first out of the Grayling checkpoint last night. It looked like mushers were a little bunched up there and taking rest before setting out for Eagle Island. We had heard that planes were unable, again for the second year in a row, to get drop bags into Eagle Island, and so mushers may have been adjusting their plans in Grayling and staying longer there than they had anticipated. The front of the pack mushers are all spread out between Grayling, Eagle Island, and Caltag. And when they get to Caltag, they're going to start heading west towards the coast when they reach the edge of Alaska, the coast of Alaska. We have more in this upcoming story from Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes about the trouble in Eagle Island. He was in Anvik. Again, that's the beginning of the Yukon River portion of the Iditarod. We're going to jump right into his story where he talked to Nicholas Petit about how Petit has been camping out more in this year's Iditarod.
Unlike previous years, Petit has mostly blown through checkpoints, opting instead to rest his team along the trail.
How's it been for you camping outside of checkpoints this whole way?
I didn't have to deal with this. No offense, but
no,
we're tired people and we got a lot of work to do.
Is it more for you or is it more for the dogs?
The both of us.
The ride to the Iditarod checkpoint was rough, with barely any snow and vicious tundra tussocks that kept nearly bucking him off his sled.
It was the roughest trip to Iditarod I've ever been on. Jokingly saying to myself, we were at tussock level number 5. Probably the close to the high rating, you know?
Even with a group of reporters, vets, race officials, and spectators, Petit was so focused on his dogs that his baggy, over-white pants kept falling down to his knees as he walked up and down the line. He seemed to hardly notice until the task at hand was over and he would hike them back up to his belly until they dropped again. In the tribal hall next to the checkpoint, Petit sat down at a folding table to a five-course meal of steak, scallops, salad, bison chili, prepared over two camp stoves.
Glass of champagne?
Sure.
Excellent. 2009, Dom Perignon.
Ladies and gentlemen, for years.
Petit left dinner for a nap, but he didn't sleep long. He pulled out of Anvik after about 4 hours. Weather along the Yukon has been messy. As the next wave of mushers came in, race judges had to give Jesse Royer and others the bad news that for the second year in a row, there were problems getting supplies to the checkpoint at Eagle Island.
Did you hear they don't have the food to Eagle Island yet?
Oh, I just asked in Shagaluk and they told me they did. There's no food?
As of right now, but they're making the effort to bring it down from Caltech.
Oh.
By snow machine, so.
Okay.
So by the time you get to Grayling,
because I'm doing my 8 in Grayling.
Yeah,
so
you might want to grab the bag.
Although there was straw and fuel available, Iditarod crews were trying to carry in mushers' drop bags with food and other supplies. Last year, weather shut down the Eagle Island checkpoint, prompting mushers to load up on supplies for the long run between Grayling and Caltag. Now, with a similar situation, mushers are having to adjust their plans on the fly as they begin moving north up the Yukon. In Anvik, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Well, one of the Iditarod's pioneers is taking one last run. Yor Olsom is carrying the ashes of longtime musher Rudy Damoski to spread along the trail. As he prepared to pass through Damoski's hometown of Anvik, Leifseth Olsom says he's humbled.
It's an honor to do that.
Damoski was a familiar face along the Iditarod Trail for decades and was instrumental in starting the Kuskokwim 300 out of Bethel. Damoski died last year at the age of 72. During Leifseth Olsom's rookie race in 2013, he met Damoski, who was running his final race. He was nicknamed the Happy Musher. And Leifseth Olsom says Damoski came to Willow a lot to help him train dogs.
He would just sit and have fun in the side-by-side, and he would look at the dogs and tell stories from the old days. And I think the main thing I learned from him was just to enjoy life. He was always such a happy guy, and even the little smallest thing would get him fired up and laughing, and all the way to the end, you know, he was just super happy. And
Damoski's roots with the race could be traced all the way back to the beginning. He ran the second Iditarod and placed fourth as a rookie. Now, back to this year's race, the moves that we're seeing at the front of the pack and other mushers moving their way up the ranks right now, that all was setting up back when they were taking their eight-hour rests, or planning them out anyway. That dangerous chase pack of mushers set themselves up to capitalize on any opportunities that may come up. Speaking of Pete Kaiser, for example, he is leading the Iditarod as I record this. It's been this cat-and-mouse game between Nicholas Petit and Yor Olsom, and then you've got teams like Pete that have been building up, and they're now moving into the lead of this race. And this pack that's chasing and sometimes overtaking Petit and Olsom, all of that shaped up before the Yukon River, back when the mushers were planning those eight-hour breaks. KNOM's Ben Matheson has more.
Pete Kaiser had one of the fastest run times Friday into Shagaluk, but what he's focused on is consistency.
One run you're fast, and the next run you're not, so we're trying to string more of those together in a row now and try to get some more consistency, because the first half of the race for us has been real up and down and real inconsistent.
Kaiser has often been conservative in the early parts of the race and waited to make a big push with a more rested team. Matthew Fahler got into Shagaluk to time his eight-hour break to avoid the heat of the day. He's being extra careful to prepare his team for the big runs ahead, including with a longer stop in Iditarod.
That gave me 5 hours of rest there when other mushers were staying for four, and then I'll stay here for eight. So I'm starting to kind of bank rest to build up for this last leg, if you will. So, I don't know. I'm not really thinking about other mushers, but, you know, trying to make sure we're doing what we're supposed to do right.
The Yukon trails are well-traveled by local snow machines, but there is snow in the forecast that could shake things up if the trail becomes marginal. Mushers will never speak openly about their exact plans for getting their team to the coast, but last year's Rookie of the Year, Jesse Holmes, says he has a few tricks up his sleeve.
These dogs have the ability to go long and fast, so I haven't used that quite yet. I used it one time, and that's what I did all the rest and implemented all the rest for, is so I could try to make big moves and when they're suitable, when the dogs are ready for them, and I made one already.
Fresh off his 24, Holmes made a long run from Ophir to Iditarod to climb the standings across the rugged terrain. The race is switching from the rolling hills of Gold Rush country to the wide expanses of the Yukon River. Paige Drobny arrived into Shagaluk in the ninth position and is eager to hit the river.
They really like, trails that they can move on, and we haven't had that for a little bit. So the run into Iditarod, when we would hit like some ice or like a road like this, you know, then they would just get cruising along really fast. And it seems like that makes everybody really happy. Then the bumpy trails that they, you know, they're constantly getting pulled on by the sled and, you know, we're pulling and pushing constantly. I don't think it's probably very comfortable for them.
And as more teams finish their breaks, they'll run with fresh legs throughout the night. For KNOM, I'm Ben Matheson in Shagaluk.
We've got more from that interview that Ben conducted with Paige Drobny. That's posted as a bonus extended interview on the Iditapod here. And I may have said in the intro to that recording that she arrived in Shagaluk in 10th. I think Ben said 9th. I'm not sure which one is right, but she was in the top 10 either way. I'm also looking at posting a long version of the Martin Apayawik Raitan interview in a little bit. Raitan, he is one of the mushers who has had to do some serious sled repairs. For these Iditarod mushers, sled problems really can upend a race. They can also give a critical edge. Some competitors try out new designs or even modifications made out on the trail to give them an advantage. Others have to try to patch up malfunctions and damage that has occurred out on the trail with just about anything they can find. It's really a struggle that inspires some creative resourcefulness. Again, here's Alaska Public Media's Zach Hughes with this report.
Jeff King likes to experiment with his equipment.
Pulling a Jeff King magic trick.
He's cranking a wrench and augering bigger holes in wide runner plastic that he hopes will help him float on top of powdery deep snow. This takes a lot more effort than swapping out regular runner plastic, but he's tried it in the past and has been pleased with the results. His sled bag, though, that is new. King tinkered with a design that doesn't have zippers or Velcro and lets him open the bag from behind like a hatch while he stands on the runners, almost like he's checking on a baby in a stroller.
I love it. Really love it because I had no idea how often I want to get in my sled, and I didn't because it's such a hassle to get in there. I just flip it up and then dig through there while I'm hauling down the trail. Yeah, I'm in it all the time. Really like that.
So far this race, King's equipment story is one of success. That's not the case for everyone, and rookies in particular face a challenge when their gear breaks down, because for many, there are inevitable problems they didn't anticipate or build a contingency plan for. Martin Reitan hit trouble early in his run towards the Alaska Range. A stanchion, one of the load-bearing pieces of the sled's frame, broke.
I had to go and chop down a tree and lash it on with a string.
Reitan rode his tree-patched sled to the next checkpoint, then shorted up some more.
That took like 3 hours to do it nice.
It was enough to get him past the Dalzell Gorge and the burn. It sort of had to. Reitan hadn't sent equipment out down the trail for these kinds of repairs, nor did he send out a backup sled in case his got busted. And even after he finishes the Iditarod, this same sled has further to go.
And I have to bring that sled to Nome because we're going to Kaktovik after.
Reitan and his father plan to mush their team from the Seward Peninsula all the way back to Kaktovik on the eastern side of the North Slope. But he wasn't too bothered about the situation. Allison Lifka, another rookie, was trying to sort out sled troubles of her own during her 24-hour rest in Takotna.
There was a certain downhill that I lost control of the team and veered off the trail a little bit and found the stump.
The stump bent a runner and tore away a big chunk of the sled.
And it's one thing to run a sled with like the back part of the runner broken, but when it's the front part, it just destroys the structural integrity. So it was like just collapsing as it ran.
Lifka jerry-rigged a splint, but the sled kept warping. At Nikolai, she had some good luck. Another musher, Shaney Traska, had just scratched and let Lifka take her sled. But the situation was not ideal. Lifka could barely fit all of her equipment, and there was no seat to rest on, which wouldn't be such a problem if she hadn't injured her back when she crashed her sled into that stump.
It's just sore and stiff. It's just me trying to make my next, 600 more miles more comfortable.
Lifka was hoping to borrow a bigger sled that another musher had left behind. Race rules allow competitors to exchange equipment with one another. If that didn't work out, she'd been advised to try tying an upside-down bucket to her runners with twine from a bale of straw. But she said that wouldn't help with the storage problem. In Takotna, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
There's one very important piece of equipment out there that helps a musher stay sane mushing over hundreds and hundreds of miles. That is a way to play music. And apparently, Matt Hall out of Two Rivers, he had to buy some headphones during the race this year for that very reason. He was at a checkpoint purchasing some headphones. It might be for listening to music, podcasts, books on tape. They kind of do it all. You hear about mushers having their friends load up iPods with different tunes that they've never heard before that surprise them in shuffle mode as different stuff comes up randomly. At the Takotna checkpoint, Zach spoke with two mushers. We heard from him here a minute ago, Martin Reitan, as well as Meredith Mapes, who finished the Iditarod in 2018. This year, not a musher in the race, but helping out at different checkpoints. It turns out that they are both very big Harry Potter fans. Martin, a self-described Gryffindor, listens to the Harry Potter books on tape, and by his 24-hour rest was on the third installment. Meredith Mapes, on the other hand, identifies as a Hufflepuff, whatever that means. Both insist their house values align with dog mushing, something Zach, who knows more about this, asked them about at length. And this is a disclaimer for people like me. If you already have no idea what any of this terminology means because you signed up for a mushing podcast, not a Harry Potter fan club podcast, you should probably skip ahead about 2.5 minutes. Here is Zachariah Hughes with Martin Reitan and Meredith Mapes.
Well, it depends, you know, you could be a Slytherin about it and like play mind games with people and stuff. But if there's like bad weather but you think you can do it, and then the weather's really bad, but you just do it. It's a little bit stupid, but it's also brave. So it's a very Gryffindor thing to do. And obviously I have to be brave to even start a 1,000-miler.
Meredith, you have finished a 1,000-miler, but you identify as a Hufflepuff. Do you think that Hufflepuff is a good mushing house?
I would say so. I think the Gryffindors and the Slytherins and the Ravenclaws are more up at the front because they're the ones that have the strategy and the guts and the glory and some of the stupidity as well, as Mark was saying. And then the Hufflepuffs are those like me that are just out there to have fun and be at the back of the pack and enjoy what they're doing while they're out there traveling with their dog teams.
What are your Harry Potter litter? What are their names?
The three that I still have are Hagrid, Luna, and Nymphadora, but she gets called Dora most of the time.
Not Nympho.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you made your way through books 1 through 3 so far while you've been listening, or did you just start at 3?
I started listening from book 1, so I'm on book 3 now. I'll probably have time to listen to all of them, but I'm mixing it up with music and some other books too.
Is it also Harry Potter themed music?
No. It's a lot of jazz and Arctic Monkeys and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Meredith, did you listen to music last year or books on tape, or what did you? Or nothing. The Sound of Silence.
I usually listen to books on tape when I'm training a lot. Mostly Game of Thrones is what I've been listening to, but I do have Harry Potter as well. And last year on the race, I listened to music on one run, like the first run on the Yukon River out of Grayling, and then after that I was just enjoying it too much. I didn't want to mess with what I was listening to with the dogs and just Alaska.
Now, at any point did you scream from your sled runners, "Winter is coming," when you were mushing through a storm last year?
I did not, but it would have been a good opportunity.
Okay, well, now you know more about that. And we like to spread knowledge around here. That's why we take questions on the Ididapod. This one is from Ruth Ann, University Heights, Ohio. She writes, "Is the race named after one checkpoint, or is the checkpoint named after the race? I assumed the checkpoints reflected the nearest settlement name." And she's asking this because there is a checkpoint in the Iditarod called Iditarod. I'm going to let Zach Hughes answer this one.
Hey, great question. So right now I'm standing on the Iditarod River, which goes past the checkpoint of Iditarod on the Iditarod sled dog race through the historic gold mining town of Iditarod in the Iditarod mining district. All of which is to say, the name has a lot of different overlapping meanings. And actually the race is named after the Iditarod Trail. So this is kind of confusing, but back when they struck gold in Iditarod, and it was the largest settlement in all of Alaska population-wise, they'd haul gold, freight, mail, passengers through a trail that went from here all the way down to Seward and up through different overlapping trails to Nome. So in 1973, when the race was getting started, they decided that this long cross-Alaska sled dog race would go through the historic Iditarod Trail. And one of the routes that they go through, the southern route, which we're running this year, goes through the ghost town of Iditarod, which, looking around, I can tell you is indeed a ghost town. There's dilapidated buildings all over the place back from when this used to have rooming houses and churches and a bank. And now it's mostly just an Iditarod checkpoint with just a few outbuildings on a river.
Thanks for that answer, Zach, from the checkpoint of Iditarod in the 2019 Iditarod. As always, on the Ididapod, we like to take listener questions. You can send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. You can type them out in an email. You can also record them in a voice memo. Most smartphones have an app to record voice memos, and you record your question there, send that on in again to iditarod@alaskapublic.org, and you could maybe get in the podcast. And it's always good to ask questions. And I have some questions. I guess there are some major weather issues happening out on the race, and we don't know how that's affecting the mushers, but also our crew out there trying to get from checkpoint to checkpoint. The last email I got from our reporter, Zach Hughes, you just heard from him, was that there was some trouble flying between some checkpoints, that Ben was trying to get to Unalakleet and might have to skip Caltag. We may not hear from mushers again until Unalakleet. And everybody's just trying to be safe out there is the main thing. It's hard to tell when you look at the map of the race or the GPS tracker that there's a lot of weather happening on the ground. It might be snow, wind. We've heard reports that it's been pretty warm and that folks are getting just wet out there from sweat and even some rain at different points. I guess Zach, he's in Unalakleet. He found a sauna. Sounds pretty happy about that. So things are looking up, but everybody's trying to stay safe. We will be back tomorrow with another episode of the Iditapod. We'll explain how daylight savings time changes affect or do not affect the race. And we'll have an interview with Kristen Knight Pace. She's a Iditarod veteran who is sitting out the race this year, but has a new book out called This Much Country. We had a nice chat, talked to her husband Andy Pace for a minute too, and whatever else we can rustle up in the Iditapod. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I am your host, Casey Grove. Until next time, happy trails.
Good boy. Quick look. Yeah, drink your water. Come on.